Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Oh, welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I am your host for the full 2 hours this weekend. Al is taking a little break from the KER Politics weekend show, so you are getting 2 full hours of market and economic commentary. In the first hour, we are going to be focusing more on broad economies and broad markets, with the second hour diving more into the resource sector, talking about some companies, but also looking at jurisdictions and some of the opportunities, not just in the precious metals that we see. That being said, I am kicking off the show with Mike Larson. You can follow Mike on Twitter at Real Mike Larson. Mike also writes the Safe Money Report. And Mike, you and I have been talking quite a bit over the last now over a year about the change in strategy when it comes to markets. And it was all, I think, being driven home a little bit more just a couple weeks ago when we really started to get some of that weak data out of the U.S. The ISM number was weak. We also saw a jobs number that, yes, unemployment did go down, but we are seeing a general slowdown in hirings. Recap some of the recent data that has creeped into the U.S. that rightfully so should be concerning for investors and even for the politicians and central bankers.
Sure. You know, we've been talking for quite some time, as you noted, about messages coming from the yield curve, the treasury market, a dramatic flattening of the treasury yield curve that was persistent, consistent, very severe. As a matter of fact, in terms of the magnitude of the flattening of the curve this time, it's the second most we've seen since the late 1980s. Basically, it's flattened more and inverted more than at any pre-recession period, except for right before the dot-com bust. So yes, that includes the sort of savings and loan and oil-driven bust in the early 90s. It includes the housing and mortgage bust in the mid-2000s. So you've been betting for a long time now, you know, several quarters now, a signal from the bond market that the investors expect the economy to weaken. Now you're seeing the data begin to confirm that. If you look over the last several weeks, ISM, the manufacturing index, was the worst in 10 years. The services sector index was the worst since 2016. So you're seeing, you know, the original manufacturing sector of the economy begin to roll over, just like you would kind of expect, given what's going on in the trade and tariff and global growth scenario, where all that's slowing down. And now you're seeing this start to spread over to services, which, you know, all the apologists who say the bond market and the yield curve, you know, it's different this time, blah, blah, blah. You know, we said, oh, well, services and consumer spending will hold up. But that's not really how this works, and it's not how it works historically. You tend to see, you know, manufacturing begin to slip first, then you see services activity begin to slow, and then you see employment begin to turn. And what we've seen in the most recent jobs figures is, yes, unemployment rate is low, but the pace of job creation is down about almost 30% from a year ago. In terms of the monthly average jobs created this year versus in 2018, is down about 30%. So still adding jobs, but adding fewer jobs. And even within the jobs report, you saw the sectors like manufacturing and retail begin to actually shed jobs. In fact, manufacturing has happened more than once. Retail lost jobs. And that's the kind of stuff that you would expect in a pre-recessionary environment. I'm not as bearish as some people who say we're actually potentially in recession now. But I think all the evidence points to that being the case beginning sometime in the first half of 2020. So I don't think it's very far around the corner. And I think that's why you've seen, you know, what we've discussed before. I mean, the stocks and the sectors that are winning in the last 18 months or so are not the same stocks and sectors that were winning in the bull market period. It was all the offensive growth type things, transports, financials, small caps, and all that, that were winning. They're losing now. They're dramatically underperforming. Meanwhile, you're seeing things like utilities, REITs, consumer staples, treasuries, gold miners, all that stuff that does better in a higher volatility, lower growth, pre-recessionary environment is doing better. So you've had to shift your strategy as an investor if you want to continue to profit in this market. Just owning the indexes is a loser strategy. It's now been 21 months in a row basically a 21-month-long period where the S&P 500 has done nothing. You've earned 10 times as much in gold mining stocks to some degree, or gold itself is outperforming the S&P dramatically. Treasuries are up something like 5 to 6 times as much as the stock market in the last 12 months. And I should tell you something. That's very different from what we saw before. And it means you've got to change your investing approach if you still want to make money in the market we have now, not the one that we had 2 years ago.
Yeah, very true. And also remember, we did have that yield curve inversion. It was very short, but that happened a few months ago, and that predicts usually a recession a year to two out. So that could all tie in with next year's recession. I want to get some quick comments from you regarding the comments made by Jerome Powell this week, where he discussed the expansion of the Fed balance sheet. We've already seen the balance sheet grow by about, well, just over $100 billion. And he's saying that expansion could continue, but he's not labeling this a QE program. To me, that seems like a bit of a disconnect in just playing with words. Either way, the Fed seems to be expanding their balance sheet, whether it's in the repo market or somewhere else that we don't know. What was your takeaway from this balance sheet expansion and seemingly Fed wanting to or willing to expand it even more?
Sure. Well, first, just to briefly close the loop on the yield curve issue, what I follow most closely, because historically it's been the best curve measure in terms of predicting recession, is the difference in yield between the three-month Treasury bill and the 10-year Treasury note. That three-month 10-year spread actually first inverted this year in March, popped out of that for a couple weeks, then re-inverted, and has been in inverted territory now for about seven total months. That's roughly similar to what we saw, again, in the periods preceding the dot-com bust, preceding the housing bust, and preceding the early 90s recession. So, and you know, it's not just that it inverted, it's that it was collapsing in terms of from the widest spread to the lowest to date inversion level has been 424 basis points, 4.25 percentage points. That's huge. Again, in magnitude, that's the worst flattening we've seen, with the exception of the pre-dot-com bust flattening in 30 years. So noteworthy there. As far as the Fed, now, you know, Jerome Powell is out there saying, oh, this is going to be like 2015, 2016, where the economy slowed because of the oil patch bust, and then it got back on its feet. And he's also comparing this to 1995 and 1998. 98 was when we had sort of the long-term capital management meltdown, and the curve temporarily inverted, the Fed cut a couple times, and that was followed by that dramatic boom that, you know, ultimately led to the dot-com bust. And then 94, 95, when the Fed achieved its only soft landing in the last 30-some-odd years. That's wishful thinking. He's wrong. The curve is behaving differently. Indicators are pointing in a different direction. So, yeah, you know, which he's not going to say. No Fed chairman is ever going to say, yeah, we screwed up and we're probably heading into recession. They just don't do that. But you're getting the same kind of happy talk you've gotten before that I think is just wrong. With regards to sort of this QE, no QE thing, what the Fed's going to do is now it's basically throwing in the towel on QT, quantitative tightening. You know, for years and years, it was saying, oh, sure, we're going to normalize the balance sheet. We're going to get back to kind of the same policy we had before the big Great Recession. And part of that was shrinking the balance sheet. But after just about a year of doing so, and, you know, only, I think, unwinding about a third of what it added during the QE days, the Fed's basically saying, you know what, the economy's not good enough. It's leading to turmoil in the repo market. We can't do it after all, so we're going to start expanding the balance sheet. But, and this is absolutely crucial, this is not the same style of QE that you saw in 1, 2, and 3, number one. Number two, 3 was less effective than 2, and 2 was less effective than 1. So, A, this is not really QE4. They're going to be using the very short end of the yield spectrum, and they're basically just going to be, you know, covering short-term overnight needs. It's not massively growing the balance sheet. And B, even if the Fed did it at this point, what would happen? You'd see basically long-term yields collapse, intermediate-term yields collapse, and investors not want to buy the same stuff they bought in the last cycles. The reason QE worked in the first place, if by worked you mean inflated risky assets, is that risk was at extreme levels back then. When you think back to just out of the recession, QE worked in collapsing risk spreads and driving stocks up because stocks were extremely cheap. Risk spreads, meaning, you know, the yields on junk bonds versus treasuries and all that, were extremely wide. The market was primed for a rebound because assets were cheap. None of that's true today. It's the exact opposite. Stocks are extremely expensive. Spreads are very low. You know, we're 11 years into this base, or essentially into this economic expansion and bull market that kind of started dying out in January of 2018. So it's the completely wrong policy for the completely wrong point in the cycle. And that's not even what they're doing yet. I have no doubt that at some point the Fed may try and pull that out again, but that's not going to happen until we roll over into a new bear market, in my opinion.
Okay, and that's what I know a lot of people are waiting for, is when will this bear market happen? But also regarding a recession, 2020, a lot of people are saying too that, you know, that's right during the election, or at least that long election season that the U.S. has. And Trump arguably does control a pretty big card if he can get some sort of a trade deal done and provide, even if it is just a short little boost, could be a boost to the markets and to just general confidence, especially out of businesses. What do you have to say to that argument?
You know, it's funny. There's a lot of talk, you're right, that heading into an election, the sitting president who's up for re-election is not going to let it happen, you know, come heck or high water. The reality is, look what happened when Obama was trying to get elected. You know, the economy was falling apart in the last cycle. Look what happened in the 2000, 2001, 2002 period. That was, you know, the economy was falling apart right around the time of an election. We're heading into recession. You know, the reality is there's not much you can do when the economic and credit cycle turn is part of it. So first of all, you can't have as much of an impact as you think you can, even if you want to. That's the first part of it. Second part of it is, why would the Democrats even go along with something aggressive if Donald Trump wanted to get something through that would help his election chances? They wouldn't. So you have political resistance to that. That's the second part of it. The third part of it is, where's the money going to come from? In most economic expansions, the government sort of steps back, you know, and instead of spending a bunch of money, takes in a lot more tax revenue that refills the coffers. And heading into a recession, it then has the sort of financial wherewithal to step in and provide a lot of aid to counter the weakness. But we didn't do that at all. This economic expansion, we were running $600, $700, $800 billion a year deficits up to $1 trillion throughout this economic expansion. There was no rebuilding of the balance sheet health of Uncle Sam, for example. And there was no, you know, again, sort of refilling the coffers for the downside. So at this point, how is there going to be a big fiscal aid package? I mean, the money just isn't there. And, you know, we also kind of had this huge corporate tax cut, which helped goose growth in the short term. But a lot of that money was just squandered on stock buybacks and financial engineering and so on by corporate America. It wasn't spent on actual productive investment, building factories, you know, increasing R&D spending and so on. So a lot of money was squandered. There was no sort of refilling the kitty during the boom times. And that means we're heading into this impending recession, neither able to nor really having the willpower and ability to get something passed. So I think it's going to be, you know, it's about a rockier road heading into this than we did have heading into the last couple of downturns in terms of what the fiscal side of the equation can actually do.
Well, that's also because we just have such low interest rates. And yeah, even as you said, these companies didn't kind of refresh the coffer over this last bull market. All they did was buy back stock and essentially take on more debt at low interest rates. So the low interest rate aspect does help them. But it's not like companies are saying we need lower interest rates to help us spend more. They're saying that we're uncertain about global growth. And in all fairness, we were seeing slow global growth even before kind of this chaos with trade wars happened. So these type of tools and these type of businesses, which are crucial, they're not seeing a whole lot of opportunity for growth. That needs to be a major concern, doesn't it?
No, it absolutely does. That's it. That's a big part of it. And, you know, I would also add that there's kind of this misconception. A lot of people, you know, sort of the Wall Street narrative is, oh, if it wasn't for this trade war, you know, if it wasn't for Trump getting into a fight with China, everything would be fine. That's just not right. The trade and tariff situation is clearly contributing to the downturn we're seeing on a global scale. But you also, if you look at the economy, you're seeing bank lending demand weaken. You're seeing credit standards begin to tighten. You're seeing credit spreads, meaning the extra risk cost that you have to take on as a company looking to borrow. Those have been widening since January 2018. You look at the auto sector, for example, it's been kind of lackluster demand there. I mean, you know, you have lenders giving out 108-month car loans and they're still not goose sales very much. Housing, it's, you know, better somewhat because of the interest rate decline, but really not anywhere near this sort of growth engine that it was in the last cycle. So even domestically, there's not a lot to point to. And you throw in the fact that sort of the one part that was working really well, this VC-funded tech boom bubble, whatever you want to call it, now that's starting to pop. That's going to have a negative impact on growth in a lot of these metros in terms of jobs, housing markets, commercial real estate demand, and so on in places like Seattle, San Francisco, Boston, New York. There's going to be issues there, too. So it all sort of paints a picture of an economy that's in trouble, that is not yet in recession, but that almost every indicator I follow kind of points to the fact that that's where we'll be next year.
Now, what about your thoughts on the IPO market, too? We've seen some pretty high-name IPOs not skyrocket after coming into the market, actually be sold off quite aggressively, and even the recent news of WeWork not even being able to get their IPO done. This is another sign, too, that there was a lot of money made in this sector, this area, but it seems to be drying up, and there just doesn't seem to be as much money available to take these really risky companies even further into, well, unicorn territory. What's your thoughts on this?
I mean, I could go on and on about that, and I'll try and keep it relatively brief. I used to work at a dot-com in the late 1990s. I graduated from college in 98 and went right to work for one. So I've seen this movie before. I know how the process works. I know what happens on the downside when it comes to layoffs and you know, spending cuts, and so all that optimism that gets, you know, burst, and all that silly behavior that seems so smart at the peak of the bubble, you know, 2 years later, you look back and say, what the heck were people thinking? That's exactly what we're seeing this time around. We had the highest percentage of money-losing IPOs in history last year. 85% of the companies that came public were losing money in the 12 months before their IPO. That was even worse than we saw at the peak of the dot-com bubble. What's interesting is that, you know, now everybody's talking about and seeing what's happening to Uber and Lyft and WeWork and Slack and all these companies whose stocks after their IPOs have been falling, or in the case of WeWork, can't even launch the IPO. But just like in the dot-com cycle, a lot of the garbage second-tier and third-tier companies back then began to collapse in the second half of 1999. The big names and then the NASDAQ itself didn't even really notice until, you know, the second or first and second quarter of 2000. So it was already happening behind the scenes then, and it's happening now. I mean, some of the crop or some of the IPOs that came out in the second half of 2018 and, you know, or spring of 2018, they had terrible fundamentals. And as soon as they came public, they started falling. You had these big one or, you know, 1 day or 1 week or 1 month pops. They're down from their post-IPO peak, 60, 70, 80%. One or two have already been delisted or are close to it. So, you know, yes, now we're hearing about it with the Ubers and Lyfts and WeWorks of the world. But this deterioration behind the scenes was already happening. It's just gaining steam and now sweeping up the bigger names, which is exactly, again, what you saw in the dot-com bust. And it's going to have a significant negative impact on the economy and the markets going forward.
All right, let's just wrap it up with kind of that portfolio management that we have talked about a number of times. Yes, sticking to some of these safer sectors as well as more recession-protected sectors. But that being said, if a recession does hit and really take hold, what needs to be the strategy then? Because some of these sectors also can get hit quite hard if there's a big liquidity squeeze and rush to cash.
Sure. I have this thing that I call my boring stock screener. I do it using the tools at the Weiss Ratings website. And I can just look at, you know, how different sectors, different ETFs, different stocks are performing. And, you know, in the last 12 months, the GDX, the VanEck Gold Miners ETF, is up more than 48%. The TLT, which owns treasury bonds, is up 31%. REITs are up 26%. Gold itself is up 26%. Utilities, 23%. Consumer staples, 16%. I mean, that tells you what's been working in this market, and that tells you what the market behind the scenes, behind just, you know, what the S&P 500 is doing, values in this market. They value steady growth, dividends, lower volatility, pre-recessionary business models. Meanwhile, the transportation ETF is down 9.5%, financials are down 1%, and the S&P 500 has basically gone nowhere. At some point, and you saw this in the dot-com cycle, at some point, even those sort of winners, those dividend-type payers, eventually, if the whole market rolls over, they get dragged down too. We have not yet seen it. I am watching for it. And some of these names in the most recent couple of weeks in Safe Money Report, our flagship newsletter, I've taken a half profits on a few of these names. I've sort of lowered the exposure overall because we may be getting close to that period. But for right now, it's, you know, you can still find select opportunities if you're careful, if you focus in those sectors, you find the names with high Weiss ratings, stable dividends, and so on. But again, at some point, you're going to have to even raise significantly higher levels of cash, add more hedges, and basically move almost completely to the sideline.
All right. Hey, Mike, always great chatting with you. Again, if you want to follow along with Mike, easily done on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Also, if you want more information on Mike and his newsletters, which include the Safe Money Report, please email me fleck@kereport.com. Mike, it's great chatting with you. Thanks for taking time on this weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. You too. Thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Mike Larson. In this segment, we are talking more market reactions as we are recording this on Friday, about halfway through the trading day on Friday, and I am chatting with Chris Temple. So, Chris, we don't have any solid details on what is going to be settled, or for that matter, not settled, with the meetings between China and the U.S., but the markets are taking at least the comments made by Trump or tweeted by Trump as quite positive that there might be something happening, because as we're recording this, the S&P, the Dow, the NASDAQ are all up almost right around 2% for both of them. It's more risk on being bought, risk off being sold off, as gold is down about $15. Chris, what do you think about all this optimistic talk before any sort of actual news on the trade front? I know we've talked about it all week, but let's just recap what we're thinking now heading into any potential news on trade.
Well, look, by and large, Corey, if you look, for example, starting with the U.S. stock market, it has been treading water basically for well over a year. You know, we've had a lot of volatility in between, but we have been what I still believe is in a long-term topping process. Whether we get back much above 3,000 on the S&P 500 above the old highs for a little while at least will probably depend on whether the rallies that are taking place as you and I are recording this are vindicated by anything of any real substance that comes out later on Friday after President Trump meets with China's Vice Premier Liu and has anything good to say or not. You know, but what people aren't keeping in mind right now fundamentally is that a lot of the stuff that's being discussed as part of some are using the term skinny deal or preliminary skinny deal, whatever you want to call it, that may come out, has already been taking place. Huawei has already been given some waivers so that U.S. companies can do some business with them in areas not viewed as being suspect national security-wise. You've already had China just last week buy a record amount of pork from the U.S. So a lot of these things out of just, you know, day-to-day bread and butter necessity have already happened. What we're going to get or not beyond that remains to be seen. You know, are we going to be back to where we were early this year before China walked away from an agreement the 1st of May where I thought the base case then was that Trump and China would agree to suspend or maybe even put in a timetable to remove some tariffs, settle a good slug of these merchandise trade things, but as part of a definable and date certain subsequent sets of steps that would address some of these other issues that need to be addressed. Maybe that's what we're going to get today. If we do, that's probably going to be taken by the markets as a good thing, and this rally could even be built on. You know, it remains to be seen. All we can do right now is speculate. I continue to maintain that the base case for the global economy still is largely unchanged, that you've got this bogging down of growth the world over because everybody took on too much debt at too low interest rates and because the central banks were too easy for over a decade. And the best that we can hope for is a slow, dull ache going forward. What will be impacted if there is any justification for the markets being exuberant over this is that a lot of money that was recently put to work in safe havens and a lot of money that was put on the sidelines will be hurriedly put back to work, at least by institutions. Whether, you know, individual investors believe all of this theater, which it still largely is or not, really won't matter. If you're a money manager and you're not already chasing the stock market higher, and something comes out at the end of the day to make everybody believe that, yep, we're on our road, the road to a deal, or everybody blinked, there's a truce, things are going to be better. And you're one of those professional money managers, you know, or whatever. If next week you're not buying stocks, you're going to get fired. You're going to be selling cars. So at least the institutions will have no choice but to chase things higher until they, you know, that momentum wanes, which won't take too long. Then we'll be back to asking ourselves from a higher level, well, gee, is the global economy really that healthy?
Yeah, it really speaks to, I think, some of the investors that we're getting into these safe havens, more the generalists. I've commented on that with a few of our guests a number of times, and they are ones that will very quickly bail out of those trades and reverse course, which is kind of what we're seeing today. But again, we just don't have any solid details. And something that you and I have talked about is just the scale of what these trade talks have gotten into, have gotten far beyond just trade. So we'll see what sort of a deal or mini deal or however they want to classify it gets done. But Chris, what does that mean for central bank policy? More importantly, the Fed. We have seen interest rates bounce a little bit. Rate cutting odds have dropped from, I believe it was over 80% to around 50% on Friday. Do you think that any sort of a deal, if we do get more of this risk on attitude from money managers, that will push back some sort of a rate cut at the next meeting?
Yes, it will. The Fed has already made clear that it is going to try and keep the markets liquid. In fact, this morning, and this probably is part of the reason too, I have to say, Corey, for the stock market rallying, though it should keep the market or the rally going in precious metals as well, but it's not, because they're selling off more because of they've been this safe trade, more to do with geopolitical things, China, Middle East, and whatnot. But the Fed just announced that they're going to extend again this so-called plumbing problem fix in the repo market now to January. So they can do that and not have to lower short-term rates. They can keep that in abeyance. They can, you know, do this new build of their balance sheet, whether Powell wants to call it QE4 or not. We all know that's what it is. They can extend that to January and make sure that they keep markets sufficiently liquid, they hope, without actually having to cut interest rates. And so if, again, this rally in the last couple of days in the stock market is vindicated by anything that can even be massaged disingenuously as you know, really good news, and the risk on mood continues past today, then most definitely that buys the Fed time. They can save some of that ammunition, and they won't cut interest rates again right away.
Okay. Yeah, and regarding some of these market moves, whether it's the move into risk on or the move out of risk off, we're not seeing any breaks, either higher or lower. Again, let's say S&P is not at all-time highs, although it is within a percent right now. And you look at something like gold has not broken out of that range that it's been trading in, or even something like GDX, as we're recording this, still very much within that range that it's set up ever since about mid-July. How important do you think it is to keep these ranges, say, for the risk off, rather than breaking below some of what it had been set up as almost a consolidation of recent breakouts?
Well, fundamentally, things are still as they should be, even though interest rates have spiked back up and gold has fluttered down, the dollar has fluttered down a little bit. The broader trends for all of them have not changed, as I see things, at least not yet. If those trends were to change, then you might have a different story. You know, I'll keep in the back of your mind that, and people like to draw different charts to justify what point they're trying to make, but you know, some people for gold, for example, they want to go back to, you know, 1,060 or 1,130 or whatever it was, the bottom. And we've had this move since then. And here's where your, you know, retracement line should be and so forth. I really, Corey, think it's more appropriate to start where you're at 1350 or 60, which for years was an important technical level, both down and up for gold. And we broke above that. That, of course, is the line that ultimately has to hold if any correction that saw the stock market really scream higher and animal spirits really go nuts, then, you know, gold is going to be susceptible. I don't expect that because of what the Fed is doing. And because, again, I think that at most what we're going to get out of anything to do with these talks with China is just going to be a quick near-term sugar high that, you know, a lot of frantic traders are going to run things up quick, but that won't last long. So I still think in the grand scheme of things, you've got a stock market that long-term is topping, and more significant durable moves, I believe, are going to be downward over the next couple or 3 years. And likewise, you're going to see treasury yields ultimately move below their all-time lows that they came close to a couple of times this year. So I'm not making any major changes to my approach, at least not yet.
So then is now an opportunity for, say, a buy the dip mentality? Or depending on what comes out of this trade, of course, could it be more of a wait for even lower levels in some of the trends that you have been playing?
You know, a lot of times as investors, we make mistakes by getting too far ahead of things. We try and chase the herd. This whole thing, even, Corey, with China has been ridiculous. And it's really become the subject for open ridicule in recent weeks, even among some of the talking heads I have on during the day on financial television. I mean, I sometimes wonder whether behind the scenes, you know, is you got Lighthizer and Liu and Mnuchin and the rest of their crews meeting today, and they're kind of sitting behind closed doors. Maybe they're playing pinochle and saying, let's see what happens if Trump sends out a tweet. Or your side, you put out a press release with such and such a word in it, and we'll see what, just for laughs, what algorithms that triggers. And then after that plays out, our side will put out a little communique, and we'll use different language, and we'll see what words the algorithm sees on there. Because that's what a lot of this, you know, really weird gyrations, whether it's on the 10-year treasury from 150 recently to back to above 190, we're about 175 today. So far, it's all of these gyrations with the stock market between 3,000 and maybe 2850 or 70, wherever the hell it was on the S&P. These gyrations are all coming from these, you know, this tug of war between whose algorithms have got more juice or more words to seize on from 1 minute to the next.
Yeah, so true. But hey, volatility, and all volatility on the back of tweets, and it's really just craziness. But hey, who knows? Maybe in a couple hours before this even airs on the radio and on our website, maybe we will get a little bit more trade clarity. But I think the real takeaway here is don't expect a major deal to be done, and don't expect whatever comes out of these trade talks to change the overall direction of the way the markets have been moving. Chris, thanks for joining us. Thanks for taking time this weekend. Everyone stick around. I'm going to be right back to wrap up the first hour. All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition. And I know I said that we would be talking about more resources and precious metals in the second hour, but we're going to dive a little bit into the resource sector here, but also comparing it to all of these recessionary fears that keep on popping up. And in all fairness, I talked about in the first couple segments of this first hour, I am chatting with Jeff Christian. He is the managing partner over at the CPM Group. Now, Jeff, there seems to be a bit of a divide here between what the CPM Group is saying and even what I'm thinking regarding an upcoming recession, and what some of the, let's call them, gold bugs are saying about this upcoming recession. We've heard it before from these gold bugs that, you know what, the financial system needs a reset, and we even hear about a potential of some gold-backed currency coming to dominate the world. But the fact of the matter is that hasn't happened yet. And while I think we can all agree that a recession could be on the horizon here, is on the horizon, we need to explain or understand what that recession could look like. Can you please break down your thoughts of the potential recession that is on the horizon and what that means for the overall financial system?
Yeah, you know, let me throw out a couple catchphrases that might help put it all into perspective. Because, yeah, you get a little uncomfortable when all of a sudden you seem to be in the same camp as the doom and gloomers. One phrase is rational expectations. I think what CPM Group's analysis tends to do is it looks at rational expectations. And those rational expectations are guided by the second catchphrase, which is probabilistic analyses. So if you look at where we are right now, we are 10 years into the longest economic expansion, probably on record. We have a lot of economic and financial and political and social problems that could upset the apple cart. We probably will see a recession. You know, our view is maybe a short, shallow one in 2020 and a bigger one in 2023, 2024. But, you know, we will see a recession or we'll see a series of recessions in the future. We'll see financial crises and stuff. But we don't expect this stuff to devolve into the end of the world. You know, there's a financial system that has actually survived for about 500-600 years. It's gone through cataclysms like the Great Depression and World War II and the Napoleonic Wars. But it's tended to survive those cataclysmic events and come back ever more stronger. And that's what happened in 2007, 2011. And that's probably what's going to happen in the future. So you have these people who are saying, okay, this is the bubble to end all bubbles, and the governments and the monetary system and the financial system cannot control this anymore, and it's all going to blow up, and the global financial system as we know it is going to collapse, and there's going to be chaos, and people are going to be eating their children. And we say, well, that's probably not going to happen. I mean, we could have a big recession. We could have a financial crisis. Things could get out of hand. But these guys have a lot of levers to pull to pull us out of there. And a lot of them, you know, have actually read history books. And they remember the French Revolution and they remember World War II. And they understand that their futures and their careers and their necks really depend on papering things over and keeping bad situations from turning into real cataclysmic situations. So our view is, yeah, we will have financial problems, and you should own gold and silver as a portfolio diversifier and as a diversifier of your wealth and as a protection against currencies rising and falling and coming and going. But you shouldn't expect this to be the end of the world. And you shouldn't expect gold to go to $5,000 or $10,000 and stay there, because probabilistically, that's not going to happen. It hasn't happened over the last 400 or 500 years, and it's probably not going to happen this time either. So, you know, that's sort of where we're shaking out. We're telling people, yeah, things are tough, things are nasty, things are scary, but let's be realistic. You should have some gold and silver in your portfolio, and some of your wealth should be denominated in gold and silver, but it's not necessarily the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah, and you're not saying the gold can't go higher. It does look like gold could go higher, but it's some of these extreme valuations of gold at 10,000 or 100,000 that, you know what, are a bit excessive in terms of some of their bullishness. But really, this whole concept predicates on the ability of central banks to continue to either paper over problems or tinker with either interest rates or what have you, use the tools that they have in their toolbox. You know what, we are already in an environment of very low interest rates, and central banks have been printing a lot of money recently without getting any inflation. But that begs the question then, do the central banks still have a lot of power and still have the tools necessary or needed to actually keep the system afloat? It sounds like you think that they do.
I think they do. I think they have a tremendous amount of ammunition still. those people who would say they're running out of bullets don't understand modern monetary systems. You know, I always get kind of confused when I see people like on the internet who clearly don't know as much about modern finance as central bank managers, but they're pontificating as if they know everything and the central bank managers don't know anything. You know, but let me take it back and give you a recent historical thing. In 2008, 2009, 2010, CPM Group was saying that we thought gold prices would rise to record levels, probably peak around 2010 or 2011, and then enter maybe a 3 to 5 year downward bear market before starting to rise again. Right. And the gold bulls just made all kinds of fun out of the fact that we thought that the gold price would rise, but peak and then fall. Well, you know what? The price peaked in 2011. It fell for 5 years and then it started rising again. But it's kind of been moving sideways since 2016. You know, and that's how markets behave. And gold and silver, like dollars and IBM shares, are markets. And they rise and they fall. And so, yeah, the price. And so what we've been saying for several years is we think that the prices will rise, that gold will probably rise to record levels, that silver could rise sharply, maybe not to record levels. But that then they'll come down again as things get papered over. And that's the way we view the world. And that's the way the world worked in 1979, 1980, when there were people saying that the everything was going to collapse. That's the way the world worked in 2001, 2008, 2009, and it's probably the way it's going to act in 2020, 2023.
Yeah, that's fair. But one other question here, because, you know, what a lot of this weakness, too, we've been seeing more globally. It started to creep into the U.S. data just a couple weeks ago. But what do you think about the overall health of China and the ability, if China goes through a severe collapse, let's say, or they go into a almost negative data scenario, that could pull down kind of the rest of the world, including the U.S., and hamper at least some of the ability of, say, the Fed to help out the U.S. economy?
That kind of problem in China could be devastating on a global basis, but it could be really devastating on a Chinese basis. And, you know, China's an interesting place. I've been spending a lot of time there the last decade or so. And China's a very interesting place because they had 400 years of revolutions and civil wars and occupation by Japan. And then the Chinese Communist Party took over and had a disastrous first 40 years of it all, or 20 or 30 years of it was disastrous before they you know, figured out some of the things they were doing wrong. And the Chinese government and Chinese leaders, I mean, their number one fear is that things go bad, because they got like 1.4 billion people and they've brought about a billion of them into lower middle class, and these people are living better than they had thought possible for generations. And the Chinese Communist Party leadership says, we have to make sure that we continue to deliver for these people, because if we don't, it's really nasty. It's nasty for us. It's heads on spikes. You know, it's a bullet to the head. But it's nasty for the Chinese people. It's nasty for the Chinese economy. And it's nasty for the world. And so I think the Chinese Communist Party will do everything in its power to avoid those sorts of really severe negative problems. And, you know, they are facing major problems, and the U.S. trade wars are exacerbating those problems. But they have a lot of levers to pull. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of resources. They have a lot of people. So I'm less concerned about that happening in China. Again, it goes back to probabilities. It's a scenario that you can draw and you can talk about. But I think a more likely scenario for China is that you see, you know, continued economic problems as the economy grows, but that they avoid that kind of really severe cataclysmic event. Now, that said, you know, the trade wars are definitely not helping them.
Yeah, no, the trade wars are not helping this. And you know what? It's a tough scenario right now just because quite frankly, we're just not getting any clarity when it comes to trade wars. But maybe at the end of these meetings, which we are recording this kind of while these meetings are going on, maybe we will see some positives. But just to recap here, you're not saying that there isn't a recession that looks likely on the horizon, and a recession is good for precious metals as people diversify into the safer assets, which we've already been seeing. But this recession isn't going to bring us back into, let's say, the Stone Age when it comes to the financial system.
Yeah, we don't expect to see a collapse of the modern economic system. We expect to see tough times. And, you know, as I said, you know, we think that we might see a shallow, short recession in 2020 papered over, and then a more serious recession and global financial crisis, similar to what we saw in 2008, 2009, 2010, and 11. But that could be like 2023, 2025. That's out there. But even then, you know, again, I mean, as scary as that was, we survived it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We came out the other side, and things, unfortunately, in a sense, kind of got worse in terms of the debt situation. But still, there is no actual drop dead point for, let's say, debt or what's going on in the system. But hey, Jeff, it's great chatting with you. I always enjoy reading over what you and the rest of the CPM group is publishing. And I think it does provide a nice commentary balancing out from some of the, let's say, more gold bug focused narrative with what's going on in the world and relating that to history. Jeff, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking time in this first hour of our show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.